Well, good afternoon, everybody, and greetings to those of you who weren't here for the study earlier. You haven't missed it. We did not get through as far as I had wanted, so I turned a Bible study into a sermon called The Kings of the South and the North. And we're going to go through Daniel chapter 11 as soon as I get unraveled here. And I wanted to use the computer. Let me plug it in. We're concerned about copyrights on some of the maps that we use this morning, so we aren't going to use maps. So we're going to the new technique. It's called spelling. How do you spell the names of Antiochus Epiphanes and Ptolemy Sopater and, you know, the Roman general Claudius Nonsensicus Scipio or whatever his name is? So what I'm going to do is just type their names. Let me do the font up there where you can actually see the font. Nice and big. That'd be great. So, one of our key players today in Daniel chapter 11, and we left off in the Bible study in verse 17 or verse 14 or 15. We'll pick up there if you'll turn to Daniel chapter 11. We were covering the dynamics that took place after Daniel. And one of the great things about the book of Daniel and about these events that we're reading about and looking at in both the study this morning and the sermon now is the book of Daniel has so many fulfilled prophecies. They're not prophecies yet to be fulfilled, but prophecies that have been fulfilled. Daniel wrote in the 500s B.C. In fact, Daniel 11, Daniel 8, which we covered this morning in the Bible study, and a little bit of Daniel 11, were written in about the 539 or 540 B.C., especially Daniel 11, because it was during the reign of Darius the Mede, which is after the Babylonians had fallen from power. The Medo-Persian Empire conquered them. Daniel worked for the governor of Babylon, and his name was Darius, and he wasn't a Persian, he was a Mede, but he was under the authority of Cyrus, who was the emperor of the Persians. So there was a great empire there that Daniel was a part of, and he wrote the prophecies down that God gave him. And in this case, we found that God gave him the prophecies, and the background of that is chapter 10 of Daniel, but it is an angelic being, presumably Gabriel. We only know the names of three angelic beings. One is Lucifer, and he's gotten a couple other names since he was called Lucifer. Satan being one, and devil is another. Satan means adversary, and devil means slanderer or accuser. The other two are Michael, the archangel Michael, mentioned twice in the book of Daniel. And then another angel, presumably, we don't know this for sure, but it's a fair surmise, is that he is also an archangel, and that's Gabriel, or Gabriel, if you are from anywhere else in the world. So Gabriel is the other one. Gabriel is the one that appeared to Daniel in chapter 9, and then in chapter 10 it doesn't explain who he is. But it seems as if he appeared as a man. Angels can do that when God tells them to. They can look like us. Well, they look like who they are, but I mean, they take on the appearance of a human being temporarily. Then they can appear in their glorified condition. And in chapter 10, Daniel is awestruck by talking to this being. And there's a process when either Mr. Miller goes through that or somebody does. I presume he will cover chapter 10, since I was supposed to do that today, along with chapter 8 and 11. And it was not until we started wading into it that there's just too much good stuff. I can't get it all out fast enough. At ABC, I can talk really fast, and the kids scribble as quick as they can. And I can cover a lot of territory. In the book of the class I'm teaching right now is a writings class for this semester. And that's just covering, we just have to cover Ruth and 1st and 2nd Chronicles and Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther and Job and Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon and Lamentations and Daniel. And you see how long it takes to get through Daniel. So I'm running behind there too. So we're ramping up. Just if we could just talk faster and maybe we can listen quicker. Like I like to say, turn your hearing up to warp 4 and you'll be able to capture some of it. This is a fascinating study, though, because we do see these prophecies Daniel wrote in the 500s being fulfilled systematically in the 300s, the 200s, and the 100s AD. And then some of them, of course, yet to be fulfilled in our day now. But we're going to be looking initially at a whole list of events that took place in the 200s and 100s B.C., just like Daniel said. So we'll go back. We have had various famous people appear on the scene in the Bible study. So to follow along with making it clear, let me spell the first important one. Whoops, where did I hit that? He is really good. Alexander the Great. Great. Okay. You can spell Alexander the Great. I'm being silly there. Alexander was phenomenal. What the Medes and the Persians had, which was a very large empire covering all the Middle East, all the way to India, all the way up into Afghanistan, and beyond into the Tarim Basin, which leads on the Silk Road up to the Xinjiang province today of China. They actually have the Tarim Basin, which is a geographical center. It's at the north side of the Himalayas, and then down out across the plain is a big basin. That was owned by the Israelites for quite a lot of the time, but at this time it was not. Persians owned it, and they extended their power all the way to Macedonia. Macedonia then is where Macedonia is now, which means it's on the northern border of Greece. So they even had holdings in Europe then, did the Persians. But Alexander the Great was great because his father Philip was tenacious. And he booted the Persians out of Macedonia. Then he began to unite the Greeks in Greece and Macedonia. Then he crossed the Bosporus in the Adriatic Sea and he united the Greeks that were on the coasts of Asia Minor, or Thrace, as it's often called, or one of the names for Thrace. And then when he had that alliance developed, that's when Alexander came into power, at about age 20. And they began their conquest east. And they went, for those days, lightning fast. And when they ran up against the Persians, it took them, once they began to fight the Persian emperors, it took them less than 2 years to subjugate the entire empire. So they stretched from Greece to India and to Afghanistan, and today Afghanistan and Turkestan and Bazookistan. No, that's not what it's called. There's another stand up there that it was in the Tarim Basin. Okay. Alexander's empire was powerful, dynamic, lasted several years, literally. And then he died. When he was 33 or 32, we aren't sure exactly when his birthday was. No cards have been excavated from, you know, the family home to be able to tell when he was actually born. So Alexander the Great died, and as Daniel prophesied in Daniel chapter 8, there would be 4, as well as in 11 earlier in this chapter, there would be 4 powers that would rise from the ashes of Alexander, so to speak. But they wouldn't have the power of Alexander, and they would not be his descendants. They were generals. They said General Seleucus controlled the northern part of the empire, which would have been from Syria. And Syria to then was where Syria today is, north of Israel. Syria all the way out toward India, toward the Indus River, and up toward Afghanistan. They didn't control that all the time, but that was the largest chunk of the empire belonged to Seleucus. General Ptolemy had been left in charge of Egypt when Alexander had conquered it, and so General Ptolemy started a dynasty, a Ptolemaic dynasty or Ptolemaic kingdom in Egypt. And then the other two, one had part of Asia Minor and the other one had basically Greece. And they became major, minor players rather, very shortly. So then you're only concerned about the king of the north, which are the Seleucids. Oh, let's see if I can spell the Seleucids. S-E-L-U-C-I-D. Whoops, no, there's no E. That's not spelled right. Although, no, just a second. Word will help us here. There it is. Wow, this is a great idea. Okay. I don't have to know how to spell it. I sort of have to know how to spell it. Seleucid Empire, named after General Seleucus. And the other one I mentioned was Ptolemy, O-L-M-E-Y. Nope. Stand by. There. Notice how dumb we get when we have computers. We don't have to remember how to spell. Word processor will tell us when we're wrong. We just have to sort of remember. Okay. So the Ptolemies were in Egypt. The Seleucids were north of Jerusalem, and the Ptolemies were south. So you had the Seleucids were the king of the north. And that is important to remember in, let's see if I can spell king. Oh, yes. And this, the Ptolemaic kings were called, each in his time, the king of the south. And you think, well, that sounds like prophecy. Well, yeah, it is, because that's the end of chapter 11. So let's jump in verse 15, we'll begin sort of the recap of one verse and then move forward. So the king of the north, who by this time is Antiochus, and this is how you spell Antiochus the third. Antiochus the third. They had been sort of fading a little bit in their power. Antiochus brought the northern kingdom back to significant power. And in verse 15, so the king of the north, in this case Antiochus the third, shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, that is Sidon, and the forces of the south, that would be Egypt, under, at that time, it was Ptolemy the fifth. Many of the kings of the south were just named after the family name. Ptolemy the fifth. Roman numerals. So Antiochus the third defeated Ptolemy the fifth, and he got Sidon back. Sidon was actually in his territory. It was up north of Israel, and he got it back in 198. That was 198 BC. And then it goes on to say, and then the forces of the south under this would be under Ptolemy the fifth, shall not withstand him. And even his, that is Ptolemy the fifth's, choice troops do not have strength to resist, or have no strength to resist. So that's verse 15. And that was how it was fulfilled in 198. And then we're in verse 16, but he, Antiochus the third again, the same one up there, who comes against him, Ptolemy the fifth, shall do according to his own will. That Antiochus will do according to his own will. And no one shall stand against him. And Antiochus shall enter he shall enter the glorious land. So Antiochus enters the glorious land. That's the Holy Land, or Judea, as it was generally called sometimes, with destruction in his power. And following the battle of Panaim, which was the one up by Sidon in 198, Antiochus got control of Judea from Egypt. Now, what we're going to find is that Judea, or the Holy Land, was yanked back and forth from Egypt to Syria, Egypt to Syria. But the worst ones when they were ruled by one of the kings from Syria, or kings of the north. Now in verse 17, he, that's Antiochus III, shall also set his face to enter the strength of his whole kingdom. And upright ones in the New King James literally means equitable things, translated in the New American Standard Bible as a proposal of peace. And a proposal of peace with him shall he, Antiochus, do. So we have Antiochus III making a proposal of peace with Ptolemy V. And he, Antiochus, shall give him, the younger Ptolemy, the daughter of women to destroy it. That is, he was giving him his daughter as a wife, but the plan was that she would betray her husband and enable her father to take control of Egypt. Unfortunately for Antiochus, his daughter was named Cleopatra. So this is where Cleopatra comes on the world scene. And instead, she betrayed her father and stayed with her husband. She, Cleopatra, shall not stand with him. She betrayed or before him. She betrayed her father, sided with her husband. It was a trick to see in the to be seen in the fact that Antiochus promised southern Syria and Judea as a dowry, but did not deliver them. He was supposed to have given Judea to her and Syria itself, but he didn't do it. So in verse 18, after this, Daniel writes, he, and the he here is Antiochus III again, shall turn his face to the coastlands. So he's going to turn his face to the coastlands. Did that happen? In fact, it did. And he will take many, he goes on to say. Because at this point, this would be about 195 B.C., here in verse 18, that Antiochus III provided asylum for Hannibal. Hannibal from Carthage. And if you remember your history, Hannibal, H-A-N-N-I-B-A-L, of Carthage. Hannibal of Carthage had fought a knockdown, drag-out, couple of wars, actually two different wars with Rome, and actually he conquered Rome at one point. So, but the first war he won, the last war he didn't win. It really doesn't make any difference if you win the first one. You always have to win the last one in any battle. And those wars were called the Punic Wars. And you wonder, why are they called Punic Wars? Because that's how the Greeks say Phoenicia. Punic. The PH, we say a PH, but in Greek, that came out P. So that's not full, it's P, and then a U sound, so Punic. Punic, the Punic language, by the way, and this is interesting, is actually a dialect of Hebrew. Same basic language the northern ten tribes spoke. So we would find among the Phoenicians traveling, because in Solomon's day, if you'll remember back in 1000 B.C., this would be 500 or 600 years earlier, or 700 years, we would find the sailors of the Phoenicians, or Punics, the Phoenicians, as we call them, we would find them sailing with the Israelites, because the men of Tyre and Sidon were sailors. That's what they did. Some of the Israelites were too, and Solomon sent them out on their three-year journeys, and what can you do in 3 years? The commentaries say, well, they sail halfway around Africa, camp for a year, get stuff, and then after a year they'd sail home. That's not what sailors do. Sailors don't need to camp. They're camping on the boat. So they sail someplace, they load up, and they sail home. They don't wait for a year and then sail home. I mean, what kind of sailors do that? You sail around the world in 3 years. Magellan in the modern world was able to prove that. Well, not Magellan. He died on the way. But his crew sailed around the world in 3 years, and thus circumnavigation was proved in that way. So the Phoenicians were great sailors, and I think they could sail around the world a long time before Magellan did in the 1500s. Okay, so we're back with this Cleopatra thing. He gets defeated because his daughter turns against him. That plot fails. So he decides to campaign on the coastlands, and he shall take many. So Antiochus III provided asylum for Hannibal of Carthage, whom the Romans had just defeated in the Second Punic War. And Hannibal assists Antiochus in landing in Greece in 192 BC. The only problem was, this was a touchstone date, 192, for the King of the North as it was then defined by this former dynasty coming from Alexander's empire. It brought him in conflict with Rome. Rome dominated Greece at the time. Greece was under their vassalage. And so they came into conflict with Rome. And so it says then, in verse 18, But a ruler shall bring the reproach against them, and to an end. And with the reproach removed, he shall turn and turn back on him. So here's what happened. A ruler happened to be Roman general Lucius Cornelius Scipio Asiaticus. And he defeated Antiochus III in Asia Minor and on the Aegean coast. So Scipio is the one that turned the reproach of defeat back on Antiochus. So suddenly Antiochus was defeated by Rome, utterly defeated by Rome, in the Battle of Magnesia, M-A-G-N-E-S-I-A, Magnesia, in 190 B.C. Then Antiochus shall turn his, in verse 19, then he, Antiochus, will turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he will stumble and fall and not be found. That's what happened. After being defeated by Rome, what forces he had left, he'd spent a great deal of money on this war. After having lost most of all he gained, Antiochus tried to recoup in 186, just several years later, recoup his losses by plundering the temple of Belus in Elymais. Elymais, E-L-Y-M-A-S-I-S, within his own kingdom, but he was defeated by local forces and killed. An ignominious end, in a sense, to one who, aspired to Roman-style greatness. Then in verse 20, then shall arise his, that would be Antiochus III, in his place, one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. So his son Seleucus the IV. So it would be, let me put down Seleucus for you, because we didn't spell it up there, and I can see how it's spelled here now. E-U-C-U-S. And in this case, he's the IV. Whoops. The IV. How come they don't think that's spelled right? It's spelled right. Can't always trust word processors. Okay. Seleucus the IV, he is actually the son of Antiochus III. He imposed taxes on the Jews, sending a tax collector whose name was Heliodorus throughout Judea in an effort to raise money because he was very financially strapped due to one of his father's defeats. But within a few days, he, Seleucus the IV, shall be destroyed. He only ruled 11 years. His father had ruled 37 years. So relatively speaking, the rule of Seleucus IV was a short one. But he will be destroyed, but not in anger or battle. He was poisoned by Heliodorus, his tax collector, who took control then of the empire, or tried to, with the backing of other Syrian officials who were tired of the excesses of the rulers. And then his, in verse 21, Seleucus IV's place shall arise a vile person. A vile person. And that vile person is none other than Antiochus. Antiochus the IV. He was also a IV Antiochus. But he had two names. Antiochus. Antiochus Epiphanes is not spelled right. No, this is spelled right. It's a Greek spelling. However, the Jews never liked him because they're really he was the evil king of the north, the worst of all. A vile person is an appropriate term. As I mentioned this morning in Bible study, the Jews called him Epimanes, I think is how it's spelled, which means instead of Antiochus, God manifest, which is what Epiphanes means in Greek, they called him Antiochus the madman, because Epimenes means madman, or the madman. So that was their nickname, the Jews, and they had a good reason for it as well. So we'll find that out as we unfold this next stretch. Antiochus Epiphanes takes over. He's the younger son of Antiochus III. And the Assyrian officials supporting Heliodorus, it says, will not give honor or royalty, but he, being Antiochus IV, shall come in, this is in verse 21, peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. And that's basically what he did. He put on Roman manners and a great deal of flattery. He enlisted the aid of a neighboring king, Eumenes II of Pergamum, which would be in Eastern Asia or Western Asia Minor, and some of the officials at home, forcing Heliodorus out, obtaining the throne. He ruled from 175 to 164 B.C. Antiochus Epiphanes. A really bad guy. Now, the reason he could do Roman manners, let me explain this. Sometimes when the Romans made treaties, and there was a time when they made a treaty with Antiochus III, they take the son of whoever they're making the treaty with, and they take him back to Rome and raise him as a hostage. So he is then educated in Rome. It works two purposes for Rome. They did this routinely for hundreds and hundreds of years. It works two purposes for them. Often they can turn that person to like the Roman way. And then if he is ever inserted back in his home country, they have a connection if it goes well. If his father doesn't do what they say, they just kill him. So it is a deterrent to, you know, misbehavior on the extended part of the empire, plus a chance to begin to inculcate the Roman approach to the next ruler. So that's why Antiochus had Roman manners. He had grown up in Rome as a hostage. With a force, which that's interesting, because the role of king of the north is going to be taken over by Rome very shortly as this chapter unfolds. Then we make that sort of light speed jump forward to the end time, the time ahead of us. And you have made this shift from the Seleucid kingdom that was originally Greek and Syrian to Rome taking its place as the king of the north in prophecy. And Rome and then those who are allied with Rome, and that's all quite fascinating stuff. Okay, now, in verse 22, with the force of a flood, that is, those who opposed him, including Heliodorus, with the force of a flood, they shall be swept away before him. So Antiochus was triumphant in his intrigue, and he got rid of this pretender to the throne. And be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. There was a Hellenistic Jew who changed his name to the Greek form. Come back and tell that. A prince of the covenant would be taken away as well. The philosophy of Antiochus was that he wanted the Jews to become like Greeks. And this is where, remember in the book of Acts, there was some conflict between those who were the brethren who were Greeks and those who were Jews. Well, the Greeks were actually Jews too, but they were Hellenized Greeks, or Hellenized Jews. I'm sorry, Hellenized means they were made to be Greekish. But Greekish, you know, you don't say, well, there are Greekish Jews, because Greekish isn't a word, and it wouldn't be spelled right if I put it down here. So the Hellenistic Jews had, you know, the Greek language, they had Greek mannerisms, they had Greek philosophies, and the really strict Jews in Israel in the time of Christ didn't like the Hellenistics. They didn't really trust them too much. So there was a conflict when we had brethren from both groups in the church. And that's why in Acts chapter 6, the apostles said, listen, we've got our hands full with prayer and the word of God and carrying on the work and trying to dodge, you know, immediate persecution. So we need some men who are completely reputable and recognized by both groups within the church. Give us some recommendations and we will appoint them to be over the business of making sure that those Hellenistic Jews, especially those who were in need, the widows and such, would be properly provided for. Many of the Greekified Jews who had come down to Jerusalem when Christ started the church, or shortly thereafter, wanted to stay and become fully grounded in the doctrine of the apostles and of the truth. Well, to be able to do that, they were going to be need to be helped by those who live there. So that was the dynamic. And the Hellenization of the Greeks, or of the Jews rather, began back in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes in the 170s and 160s BC. He began to have a significant influence. There was a high priest there named Onias, O-N-A-I-S. And Antiochus deposed him and replaced him with his brother, whose name was Jonathan. Jonathan immediately changed his name to the Greek version of Jonathan, which is Jason, which is what I'm mentioning right now. And Jason became the high priest. And then he was dropped from that position 3 years later in favor of another Hellenistic but disreputable or apostate Jew named Menelaus. So, Jason, I don't need to spell. I will spell Menelaus. No, it's not that. A-U-S. Menelaus was his name. But that really irritated Jason, of course. So you had more conflict among the Jews, the backers of Menelaus fighting with the backers of Jason at a certain point. Okay, so we find out we were in verse 23. Let me see where verse 23 begins in these notes. Ah, there it is. And after the league, that is the treaty or agreement, is made by the Jews, that is, with Antiochus the Fourth, then he, Antiochus the Fourth, shall act deceitfully, for shall come up and be strong, at first only, be strong with a small number of people. Now, his intrigue or his deception was already worked between Jason and Menelaus because he had sold out one for the other. And he shall enter peaceably into the richest places of the province, that would be invading Galilee, and he shall do what his fathers had not done nor his forefathers. He will disperse among them the plunder, the spoil, and riches. And he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. And the history record shows that Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes, moved into the northern reaches of the Holy Land, and he took the wealth from the rich people and gave it to the poor people so he could build a fanatical support among the masses in that part of the country. That was part of how he was wielding his power, causing division at every turn. In the second part of 25, he, and he is, of course, Antiochus again, shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south. So he's getting his blood up to go down and fight with the Greeks that were ruling in Egypt, which is now Ptolemy the sixth. There we go. Whoops, I forgot to capitalize the I, and it doesn't count if you don't. Okay. Ptolemy the sixth is now in power there. He's the son of Ptolemy the fifth and Cleopatra, so this would be Cleopatra's son that he's fighting. He's actually also, therefore, the nephew of Antiochus the fourth, which is Antiochus Epiphanes, because Cleopatra and this evil Antiochus were brother and sister. He went down there with a great army in verse 25, and then continuing in the middle of the verse, and the king of the south, which is Ptolemy now the sixth, shall be stirred up to battle in a great and mighty army. Now, what happened was that Egypt threatened war to claim the dowry that had been promised for Cleopatra long before. By this time, she was dead, and so they wanted to come back and get that dowry of Syria and Judea. Therefore, Antiochus IV marched south in 171 B.C., so this is the time of this big battle. At the same time, his nephew Ptolemy VI is leading another huge army out of Egypt, and they rendezvous for a big fight. And so in the last half of verse 25, but he, meaning Ptolemy VI here, shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat the portion of his delicacies, that is Ptolemy VI's own trusted officers, will destroy him. Basically, his chance for victory, destroyed his chance for victory against his uncle by plotting against him. And his army, it goes on to say, shall be swept away and many shall fall down slain. So what happened was that Antiochus IV was victorious at Pelusium, which was the name of the battle location, and he took his nephew Ptolemy VI captive and marching to Memphis, and that's not Tennessee, that's in Egypt, proceeded to use him as a tool to reduce the overall strength of Egypt. So in verse 27, we read, both these kings, Antiochus IV and Ptolemy VI, hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. And what this seems to describe an occasion in several years later, in 174 B.C., when Antiochus IV and Ptolemy VI both sat at a banquet together, with Antiochus pretending to ally himself with his nephew against his brother, his brother's name isn't important, but with each actually trying to deceive the other. It was like cheating at poker truthfully. You're gambling to start with, and then you're lying that you're cheating, that you're not cheating. You know, you see how it's convoluted it gets. It's the kind of games that mankind has always played. The story of man, really, in many respects. They were each lying to try to get ahead of the other. But it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. In other words, as God determined it. Now we come to verse 28. While returning to his land, this is a reference to Antiochus now going back north, back to Syria. As returning to his land with great riches, he plundered Egypt. His heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant, that is the Jewish worship system, so he shall do damage. He looted the temple and took many of the golden vessels, and he massacred thousands of Jews as he went back up through the Promised Land. He was a vile person. And then, and returned to his own land after that. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant, and he shall do damage and return to his own land. And he did a lot of damage, like he looted the temple, killed many, many of the Jews. And they were the only people on earth at that time who were truly trying to follow God's way. They were the faithful ones. Not all of them were converted, but they were the ones with the truth. Then in verse 29 in the beginning, at the appointed time, that would be later, this by the way, this occurred in 168 B.C. when he looted the temple. Okay, later in the same year, Antiochus, he shall return and go toward the south, you know, hearing rumblings from Egypt. So he heads south again in 168, but it, that is the outcome of what was happened, shall not be successful like the former or the latter. Then in verse 30 at the beginning, four ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Okay, you say ships from Cyprus. Well, Cyprus is an island off the coast of Asia Minor, south of Asia Minor and west of the northern end of Israel. Well, the word Cyprus in Greek means Kittim in Hebrew. K-I-T-T-I-M, Kittim. K-I-T-T-I-M. And all it means is western lands. So that was a name that was ascribed to Cyprus because it was a land in the ocean that was west of Israel, the first thing you came to. But in this case, it applied to Rome because Rome was also a western land. And with the events that were transpiring, they'd already run up against his father, had run up against Rome and Greece. Now, Antiochus the Fourth runs up against the Romans. In fact, when he got to Egypt, he was forced to accept surrender terms from Popilius, commander of the Roman fleet. And Antiochus the Fourth had to cease from his campaign against Egypt and restore the land of Cyprus to Egyptian rule. See, he owned Cyprus at the time. The history record says the ambassador from the Roman drew a large circle around him, and he says, before you leave this circle, it was a big meeting, it was outdoors, he drew a circle in the sand, before you leave this circle, you must accept our terms. You know, there's a Roman way of doing things. We want everything, and then get out of here. If you don't want to give us everything, you won't leave the circle. Ever. So he realized that he had no ability to fight all of Rome, so he agreed. And then he beat a hasty retreat. But needless to say, Antiochus Epiphanes was very angry, or very put out, as they would say in England. So in the last half of verse 30, therefore he, that is Antiochus, shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant. And Holy Covenant, and do damage. So he's going to do damage again. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So returning home through Judea, Antiochus vented his fury on the Jews, but he accorded special favor to those among them who rejected their religion and adopted the Greek, pagan Greek culture. They even built a gymnasium in Jerusalem, and some of the priests would then practice all the regular Greek games, including wrestling in the nude, according to historians that have chronicled that. So this is all still in 168 BC. It was a banner year. So in verse 31, and the forces shall be mustered by him, that is by Antiochus Epiphanes, and they, his forces, that is, shall defile the sanctuary fortress, which is the temple. And he did that by sacrificing a pig on the altar of burnt offerings. And then they, Antiochus the forces, and then they shall take away the daily sacrifices. Then he passed a law that it forbade the Jews to offer the evening and morning sacrifices or any other sacrifices, and stopped circumcision and made illegal all the Jewish practices. He made them illegal. And there the abomination of desolation at the end of the verse. That was a statue of the Greek god Zeus that was set up inside the temple. So he desecrated everything that was righteous and everything that was, of God's way in Jerusalem. And you can see why then the Jews did not like Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a vile person, a forerunner. Historically, he's a forerunner of the beast, the one who rules the beast power in the end of the age. So then in verse 32, those who do wickedly against the covenant, that would be the apostate Jews, he, Antiochus IV, shall corrupt with flattery. And many Jews did succumb to his corruption and persecuted the faithful in reward for them, the apostates, rejecting their religion. Now, in the second half of verse 32, we have the other hand. On the other hand, in essence, starting with the word but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. The people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. So what great exploits did they carry out, and who does that apply to? We are at a changing time in this chapter and in this march of events. For starters, it applied to the Maccabees, the Maccabean family, headed by one Judas Maccabeus. He was a Hasmonean or Hasmonean priest, and it was a priestly dynasty that came from him, so he was a descendant of Aaron. He had five sons. They started a guerrilla war against the forces of the Greeks, Antiochus Epiphanes. And, in due course, They gradually drove them out and established Jewish independence. It took a while, but they got it. So verse 32 seems to have a dual application. The people who know their God can refer to the Maccabees in the 160s BC. And the celebration of Hanukkah is a celebration of when they were triumphant and then they were able to re-cleanse the temple and restart the sacrifices. And if I remember the story correctly, when they got back and they had control of Jerusalem, control of the temple, and they were ready to restart things, they had only enough consecrated oil. And they had, the oil had to be mixed according to a recipe that had been handed down from the time of Moses. And so they had only a certain amount, enough to burn for a day. But it would take them days to prepare more. Well, they weren't going to wait. They were going to burn it on faith. So they lit the fire that was supposed to be kept burning, almost like sort of an eternal flame, as we refer to at Arlington Cemetery in America. They lit the flame, and the amount of oil in the container should have lasted for a day, but it lasted for 8 days. Hence the Festival of Lights, the Hanukkah. And then, by then they had more oil, presumably, than prepared and ready to go. So the dual application is that the people who do the great exploits in following and worshiping their God were the Maccabees and those who were supporters of them, but it looks forward to the time, to the time of true Christianity, the time of Christ and the church and us, even today. It looks forward to us. We also should be, how did the phrasing go in that verse? The people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. God expects that of us as well. It's not just a history sermon. When you read history, suddenly you learn something. Now we come to verse 33. Verse 33, therefore, has a dual application. Let's read it. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, verse 34, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. Understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, make them white until the time of the end, because it is still the appointed time. So let's look at these two verses and see in a fulfillment the church itself. Those of the people who understand, this would be the Christians, and we mean the true Christians because initially that's all there were. It was a century or so before you had the other. Shall instruct many. They will preach the gospel as a witness to all nations, even as we're continuing to do now. Yet for many days they shall fall as in death through persecution, starting with Stephen, then James, the apostle. Peter and Paul were martyred, according to tradition, and many others. John was the only of the 12 that we know for certain didn't die a death of martyrdom. Persecution was rampant. Paul himself, before he was converted, had many Christians put to death and many others beaten, and so they fell in another way. Now, when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, that is, a little of God's Spirit providing a tremendous ability to remain faithful and steadfast in the face of persecution and martyrdom, something we don't often think about in our comfortable times. But you know, we need to. We need to be willing, in a heart's beat, to give our life for Christ. Now, not that we're asking for that to happen, but we need to have crossed the bridge in our hearts and minds and in prayer so that we're willing to do that. Because that's what we promised Him when we repented, when we were baptized. We gave our life to Christ and to the Father. So we have a duty to be prepared for that. I mean, look at our ancestors spiritually. They were prepared for it. They fulfilled this prophecy time and again and time and again. But many shall join with them by intrigue. False prophets coming among them. False brethren. Acts chapter 20, for a reference, verses 29 to 30. Paul warned the elders from Ephesus. He met with them in Miletus, which is just south of Ephesus. Ephesus is right there in Asia Minor. Remember, it was on that mail route. But Miletus was the port city about 30 miles away. And Paul was on his way to Jerusalem. That's when he got arrested and then got to Rome by being a prisoner and so on. So he met with the elders and he told them that after I leave, savage wolves will come among you and some from within you would come up. And there are warnings about heresies and intrigue within the church. And about that, we are entirely knowledgeable in our modern era, for we have seen it happen to us as well, just like it happened to our brethren back then. And some of those who have of understanding shall fall to refine them, to purify them and make them white until the time of the end. And so likewise, the church goes through experiences because it purifies us. It makes us white in the sense of having the white robes and righteous and faithful. The tests and trials. The Apostle Peter called that the fiery trial. Don't be surprised about the fiery trial, he said. That we need to be prepared for those sorts of things. This process that began in Christ's day is going to continue until the time of his return to refine the character of Christians and make them spiritually white or pure. Now, there's a short passage we could turn to in Revelation 6, though. I think this would be appropriate to read a couple of verses there on this regard, because this is where it really strikes home to us. Revelation chapter 6, and it's the fifth seal, the time of great tribulation. In verse 9 through 11, when he opened the fifth seal, John is speaking, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony that they held. So this is a historical commentary by the time we get to just before Christ's return. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And then a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was completed. And you say, well, how could they talk if they were still to rest as in the grave a little longer? Well, they weren't talking. It's called personification. It's a literary technique. In essence, their deaths call out. And if you read anything, any kind of writing, you know the technique of personification. But it talks about the time of martyrdom and persecutions periodically. Middle Ages was another terrible time of persecution of God's true church. In fact, there were a lot of people that were persecuted, even if they weren't a part of the true church. Because ecclesiastic authorities tended to get rather vicious, particular ones especially. And so they will at the end of the age. Now, we're in verse 36. Because this moves us forward from the time of Daniel and the time of before, right into the New Testament times. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god and shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what had been determined shall be done. So that's verse 36. So this is New Testament times. Then the king. Now the king in the context at this point is the king of the north, which is now the Roman emperor. Because Rome essentially in due course had taken over. They had defeated Antiochus the Fourth in Egypt. They defeated his father in Greece. And ultimately Rome took over as the king of the north. They superseded Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes was nothing but a forerunner or a foretaste of what Roman emperors routinely would be. And what they did routinely is that they exalted and magnified themselves above every god, any of the pagan gods, that they believed that the emperor himself was God, and the emperor believed that too. And they got that idea from ancient Egypt, of course, and probably Babylon, part of the Babylon mystery religion. Okay, then in verse 37, he, in this case it is the Roman emperor, shall regard neither the God of his fathers, and the word God there in the New King James is translated from the Hebrew Elohim, and probably is much more, much clearer, meaning the gods. Elohim is a plural in that sense, the gods of his fathers. In other words, he didn't regard the gods even of his Roman fathers, the Roman god, the old Roman gods, nor the desire of women. Now, that indicates that he was either homosexual, or he was exalting himself above the Babylonian god Tammuz, which was the Babylonian Messiah for whom women wept. And you can see a reference to them weeping for Tammuz. And these were Jews weeping for Tammuz in Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 14. Ezekiel 8 and verse 14. Now, Tammuz has gotten other names in other cultures, but essentially the same role. He was the false Messiah. Now, when it says the desire of women, 14 out of the first 15 Roman emperors were homosexual, or probably not that. They were probably bisexual. Sexual perversion in the Roman era was pervasive everywhere. Nor regard any god. He will not regard the desire of women or regard any god, for he will exalt himself above them all. And again, the Roman emperors instituted emperor worship. That was a part of what they thought held Rome together, and a part of their megalomania. And Antiochus Epiphanes is definitely a forerunner of that in the way that he treated God's people, at that time the Jews. Now in verse 38, but in their place he, the Roman emperor, shall honor a god of fortresses in the New King James, or in the Old King James, it's a god of forces. And the New King James Study Bible has a reference. Essentially, it means the god of power. That the Roman emperor honors the god of power. Historically, they do that. They demanded the worship of the strength of the empire. The standards were typically idolatrous emblems of empire and emperor worship, and the extravagant spending that Rome did to build the strongest military power the world had ever seen. Rome didn't have, this was one of their great failings too, they spent everything on the military. And the only way to pay the military is for the military to conquer more lands and peoples so they could steal everything they had in order to pay the military. And you think, well, what happens when you don't get out there and do it? Well, that makes the military really mad. And so then they decide one of their generals should be the emperor. And then he takes over with the same policies. I mean, if they didn't work for the people before me, they'd sure to work for me. The philosophy there. But worshiping power was what Rome did. That is their force. And you stop and think about that, sounds oh so strangely like the prophecies about the end of the age and the beast power. Oh yes, indeed. Very, very similar. Because ancient Rome is a forerunner of modern Rome, the final Rome, the final power that will come in the years right ahead of us. So continuing in the middle of verse 38, and a god, which his, the Roman emperor's fathers did not know, shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. So, what god did the Roman emperor's fathers not know? And that would be the papacy. It's starting with Constantine the Great in the 300s A.D., 313 A.D., He, at the Edict of Milan, he made Christianity a legal religion. And between then and the Council of Nicaea in 325 A.D., Constantine made Christianity, and we mean the other Christianity, which we might call now respectfully traditional Christianity, made that Christianity the religion of the empire. That was the empire's religion. And that church worked in concert with the Roman powers, and later when Rome eventually fell, well, they built on completely corrupt foundations, the Roman system, the church had adopted its approach. And so that then provided a superstructure for anybody else who was converted by them, whether the Frankish kings or later the English kings, till they got fed up with it in the Protestant era, but that was hundreds of years later. So they were powerful, and they were wealthy. They were given a great deal of money, or they got a great deal of money, one way or another. In verse 39, thus he, and the he here is the later Roman emperors, successors of the Roman kingdoms that I just mentioned, shall act against the strongest fortresses, that is, enemy states or other religious institutions, with a foreign god, and by foreign here, you can trace the roots of the papacy back to the Babylon mystery religion. And so it's a foreign god in that sense, which he, in this case the he is the successive Roman rulers, shall acknowledge and advance its glory. And he, those successive Roman rulers again, shall cause them, that is those who sit in the papacy, to rule over many and divide the land for gain, for both the church and the state. And that's typically what happens. You see, Daniel made these prophecies, and you look at the prophecies, and then you compare it with historical events, and you have a line of events from the branches of Alexander's empire, and then moving forward, and then Rome begins to take over the position temporarily of king of the south, but dominates the position of the king of the north, and then all of these other things march down through time, and you begin to see how those prophecies have come to fulfillment hundreds and hundreds of years after Daniel gave them. Though we now come to the final section of the chapter, starting in verse 40, and this will come to pass just like all the rest have already done. And by the way, we aren't the only ones that see those historical fulfillments of Daniel. We didn't write the line, the sentence that I quoted in Bible study that said that just in the chapter 11 alone, over 100 different historical fulfillments can be chronicled for Daniel's prophecy. Over 100 in just that chapter alone, but there were others in his other chapters. It shows that God makes specific prophecies and he makes them come to pass whenever he chooses. And that's the true God that we worship. And there's always reason for what he does. And it's a good reason, the right reason. So the previous section we've covered spanned the centuries from the beginning of Christianity in the early Roman Empire to the inception of the Catholic-dominated Holy Roman Empire system and its subsequent development up to modern times. So, and by that I meant, let's see, that would have been verse 32 up to verse 39. Now, the last section starts in verse 40. So, at the time of the end, now that phrase we know, because we're in the beginnings of it. We've been in the beginnings of it for a long time. Maybe we are at the end of the beginnings. Probably more likely we're at the end of the middle. Of the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, meaning again the king of the north, and the king of the north shall come against him, meaning the king of the south, like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. Okay, now we'll pause there and go back. Now, the time of the end, the king of the south. So who is the king of the south? Well, the king of the south, as the maps showed and we talked about earlier, was centered in Egypt. Egypt was south of Jerusalem. In the Bible, when the general directions are given, unless otherwise specified, they are referenced to Jerusalem. So south is south of Jerusalem, north is north of Jerusalem, east and west accordingly. So we have then the king of the south was based in the earlier part of the prophecy in Egypt and the peoples there. And we think, well, what's Egypt got that Saudi Arabia doesn't have? Well, I don't know. Maybe it'll come out of Saudi Arabia. But Egypt has been the site. And when I say Egypt, you got to extend it further south, almost to Ethiopia. You've got to include the Sudan down there. That's all part of what has at times been historically Egypt. And that is where the great Mahdi movements occurred in the late 1800s. The British fought those Mahdis. Mahdi is the Arabic term for Messiah. So it was the Islamic Messiah movements. General Gordon, a great general of the British Army, was involved in trying to pacify that kind of unrest in Khartoum on the Nile River at the south part of Egypt. I think actually Khartoum is in the Sudan. And Victor Kubik flew through Khartoum on his way down to Africa recently to ordain two new elders and visit the churches. And so he talked about going to Khartoum. It's where General Gordon died in the service of Great Britain, because Britain controlled everything ultimately from Cairo clear to the Cape. They had a solid string of nations at the height of the empire that they dominated and ruled. And in generally, for the good of the people, they stopped the internecine wars in those kinds of places, the intertribal warfare, that sort of thing. They built infrastructure, they established education systems, and they did some good at that time. But the King of the South is where that, and the South is typically where that Mahdi movement has begun. So we would look at the King of the South, probably an end-time Islamic leader, one viewed as a Messiah-like person to the Arabs and others who are of Islam, particularly of the Arabs, though. And you think, yes, but Egypt? Okay, let's go back in our own modern history. Egypt has been quiet until the Muslim Spring 2 years ago. Prior to that, it had been totally quiet for a long time, to where you begin to think that Egypt isn't a great nation, but it is. In 1978, Egypt's President Anwar Sadat, who Mr. Armstrong visited with many times, Anwar Sadat met with Menachem Begin, who was then the Prime Minister of the State of Israel, and Camp David with President Carter, and they signed the Camp David Accord, which brought peace between Israel and Egypt. And they recognized each other's, you know, right to exist and exchanged ambassadors and the whole thing. But before 1978, what was it like? Well, before 1978, Egypt was having trouble maintaining equilibrium. Remember, they had fought 5 years earlier a battle. They led the battle against Israel in the 1973 Yom Kippur War. And the previous war before that was in 1967, when all the Arab nations surrounding Israel attacked. That was called the Six-Day War, because that's how long it lasted. It's kind of a fiasco from the Arabs' point of view. The president of Egypt at that time was Abdul Nasser, N-A-S-S-A-R. His vice president was Anwar Sadat. And prior to that time, in 1956, was another war. And that one was also led by Egypt. Abdul Nasser did not just rule Egypt. He ruled what they called the United Arab Republics, which included the nation of Jordan. They had an alliance, and then he was the leader of that, not just of Egypt. So Egypt is a very keen power player, and I expect that it will be again, because that seems to be what we read here. So the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and many ships, modern warfare vehicles, you know, have land, sea, and air. And he, in modern times now, will be the beast, the king of the north, shall enter the countries of the Middle East, of course, because that's where it's centered here, and overwhelm them and pass through, and in verse 41, and he shall also enter the glorious land. He'll overrun it just like Antiochus had done, and other emperors had done, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape his hand. And he lists three: Edom, the area of Edom, of Moab, and Ammon. And if you go back and historically study where Edom and Moab and Ammon's traditional territory was, immediately east of Israel, you'll find that that is basically the boundary of the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan today. For some reason, Jordan escapes. Well, we've speculated, but we don't really know why. But there is some reason for that. And these territories constitute, again, the modern nation of Jordan. Then in verse 42, he, meaning the king of the north, who is the beast, north because they have displaced way back when, Antiochus Epiphanes, and him as king of the north, and north because Europe is also north of Israel. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Oh, so Egypt is singled out as being a target. And he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and all the precious things of Egypt. Of course, some say Egypt doesn't have very many precious things that we know about. Well, it doesn't right now. So what do we not know about? How long has it been since we've known about the oil or the gas reserves under Ohio and Pennsylvania? You never know. When suddenly you realize, whoa, they do have gold and silver and such and such. Also the Libyans, that would be largely including the inhabitants of modern Libya, but possibly including all of North and West Africa, and the Ethiopians. The Cushites are the Ethiopians, including the people of modern Ethiopia, probably the Sudan, but perhaps meaning all of East and Southern Africa, as well as Northern Africa. So you may see in a significant African alliance where they follow at his heels, at the beast's heels. Now we'll see exactly how that unfolds, but when we see how history has unfolded in the early part of the chapter, then suddenly this section starts to sort of come to life in the possibilities of how things could go. And then in verse 44, but the news from the east and the north, that would be opposing nations, north and east, that would point toward Asia. You know, the where Russia would be north, and then the Chinese maybe to the east. They point that those directions. News of the east and the north shall trouble him, and there that is the beast, the king of the north. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And when you read through Revelation, you find that the beast comes to power, and then there is this attack and counterattack between the western power of the beast and the eastern powers, presumably some sort of Asiatic federation, because that's who's in the east. And he, the king of the north again, in verse 45, shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas. The seas, when referencing Jerusalem, are the Dead Sea to the east and the Mediterranean Sea to the west. So they would be planted between the seas. That would be where Jerusalem is, by the way. And that's presumably what he's saying. And the glorious holy mountain. So they'll be in Jerusalem. And other prophecies indicate that Jerusalem will be the focal point of that time. Yet he, in verse 45, the beast again, the north, king of the north, shall come to his end, and no one will help him. Thus, we get down to the end of Daniel 11, the end of this final king of the north, as we've seen a successive line of the kings of the north. The end of the final king of the north will be when Jesus Christ returns and establishes the kingdom of God. And after the kingdom of God is established, then all of this is just history. Some of it is just history to us right now, but some of it is prophecy in the days ahead. And there are challenges and faith to be exhibited and challenges to be faced, prayers to be prayed. So I hope you found this interesting. And again, I want to thank you all for your warm reception. We always love coming up here. I would ask you one thing. Please remember Mr. Luker in your prayers. He's battling a kidney and bladder infection right now. And I know he'd appreciate that. It is improving. Talked to him last night on the phone as we were driving up. And with that, we'll end.